Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh yeah, started to burn too many things we found. That's the wonderful Darwin singing with the legendary Pete Seeger and David Burns, who wrote the lyrics to the song, except for one word, Solartopia, which I wrote. This is Harvey Sluggo Wasserman. Back to you with another hour here in the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show at PRN. Thank you to the crew in New York, and thank you, Mark Jacobson, for joining us. Mark, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Mark, you're talking to us from Stanford, California, where you are a professor. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, very good. And Linda Seeley, are you with us from San Luis Obispo? Linda Seeley, you there? Not yet. Okay. And Paul Kangas, how about you?
I am here, Harvey, yes.
All right, great. You are in San
Francisco. We have to throw all the money we can find at solving this global crisis.
Absolutely, and you are in the San Francisco Bay Area, where you attended the Global Climate Summit, and we will soon be joined by Linda Seeley in San Luis Obispo, California, I hope, although she had an emergency last week. We hope she doesn't have one this week. I am talking to you from Los Angeles, so we are covering the state of California. In today's show, we're going to focus primarily on energy, nuclear power, global warming, and renewable energy. But first, I want to do two things. I want to celebrate the September 17th permanent shutdown of the Oyster Creek nuclear power plant in New Jersey. It was the oldest reactor in the country. The owners threw in the towel, a most embrittled reactor in the country, and certainly completely uneconomic. And so we are down now, I believe, to 98 operating commercial reactors in the country, although the two at Brunswick in North Carolina are currently shut. They were flooded, actually, or no, the reactor core wasn't flooded, but that we know of, I'd like to find that out, actually. I'm assuming it wasn't. I think we would have read about it maybe if it had been. But the floodwaters from Hurricane Florence made the reactor inaccessible from the outside. Now, apparently they had a double shift of crew on the site, but they did shut the reactor and the two reactors there. So at least for a while, we were down to 96. But on a permanent basis now, Oyster Creek is gone. We're down to 98. And what we want to talk about today, among other things, is the two reactors at Diablo Canyon and how we can get them shut. I do want to mention also, before we get too far into this, because I know that once we get started, Mark Jacobson is one of the world's leading experts on renewables, and Paul Kangas has been on our show many times to talk about that. I did see last night the new Michael Moore movie, Fahrenheit 11/9, is quite devastating. It's very worth seeing. I'm going to recommend that anybody listening to the show be sure and go to see Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 11/9. It opens Friday, tomorrow, all over the country. I saw a preview here in Los Angeles. Michael was there. I've known Michael for many, many years. He's a really good guy, and the film is devastating. And it does have a major environmental component in it. A good part of the movie is taken up with dealing with the water crisis in Flint, which is completely a man-made, a capitalist-made, baronial-made crisis that had to do with, there was a good pipeline, perfectly serviceable pipeline, bringing water into Flint from the Great Lakes. And for strictly private, commercial, financial reasons, they shut that pipeline and force the people in Flint to drink river water, which is completely filthy, poisoned, and all these poor kids and families in Flint are being absolutely devastated by this terrible, terrible water. I got to say that Michael doesn't pull any punches. He really goes after Obama and the corporate Democrats, as well as, of course, as Trump and the plutocrats. And there's a very substantial section of this film that very clearly compares Trump to Hitler, complete with footage of Hitler. And at one point, he's got Hitler speaking and on video, and he has Trump's voice coming out. To me, it's perfectly reasonable, logical, and convincing. So this is Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 11/9. It opens tomorrow in theaters all over the country. I saw a preview last night. Did hear Michael talk about it. Had a few words with him. And I highly recommend that you see this film. It's it is 2 hours long, so pack a lunch. Definitely go see it. Nothing in there about nuclear power, but plenty about water, which is absolutely something that we need to talk about more and more. Mark Jacobson, I'm going to start with you. You are one of the world's leading climate experts, as is Paul Genghis. Mark, were you at the climate summit in San Francisco?
Yes, I attended part of it.
Okay. And, Paul, you were there through the whole thing.
I was there through the whole thing. I met Jerry Brown while I was there.
What do you have to say? Was he glad to see you?
Well, yeah, he was being hustled between different speaking engagements, but we were both at the same booth getting a free T-shirt. And it was amazing. You know, I'm standing there getting a free T-shirt at the end, and all of a sudden Jerry Brown walks up, and he asks for a free yellow T-shirt for the event. And so they were rushing him off to another event, but he gave a very good speech both in the beginning and at the end of the thing. He was the last speaker. The problem is that everybody there had their own agenda, and they did not agree to all come to agreement on at least one point. You know, if they could have had some sort of plan to each speak on one point where they all agree on, that would have created some progress, but everybody was just speaking on their agenda, and it was disorganized. It was like a room full of cats. They were all going in different directions. The only thing they had in common was everybody was scared and depressed that the situation is out of hand, and they don't know what to do. Fortunately, Mark D. Jacobson Hans Joseph Fell and I all spent an hour together one day at the Intersolar, so we have some idea what to do.
Mark Jacobson, what do you think about what happened at the climate summit?
Well, I think it was very important, what happened before it, which was Jerry Brown signing SB 100 and issuing an executive order. SB 100, of course, calls for effectively 100% clean and renewable energy in California by 2045, 60% by 2030. The remaining 40% are eligible renewables, large hydro, or some zero carbon technologies that haven't been invented yet by 2045. So that's effectively 100% renewables. And he also signed an executive order which mandates pretty much all energy be clean, renewable energy by 2045 as well, although that's not a state law. That's an executive order that could expire with another governor. But that was really the main thing. The rest of it was kind of window dressing, people being supportive of this goal and rallying around it. So I think that was effective. And there were, I'm sure, as Paul says, a lot of people thinking independently about, but, you know, I was really looking at the bigger picture about the importance of this new state law and how it would affect other states as well as countries around the world and how we can then move forward on addressing climate and air pollution and energy security.
Well, how enforceable is this actual law? What is the mechanism by which the state will be forced or incentivized or otherwise pushed to go 100% renewable. Paul, do you want to start with that and then Mark?
So it's enforceable. It's sort of the problem is the system. It's enforceable if people agree to do it. It's enforceable if people have a common goal where they're working on a similar project. I like SB 100 because it does, in fact, create a situation where it is enforceable, but it's not a collective effort. It's not being done in an organized way. It's like it's enforceable if people agree to follow the law.
So how, Mark Jacobson, are you still with us, sir?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, so how does this happen? Okay, the state has set a law. By law, the state has to be 100% renewable by 2050 and 60% by 2030. Is that right? Did I get the numbers right?
100% by 2045 and 60% by 2030.
Okay, so how does that happen? How does this law make that happen?
Yeah, the state, charges the different agencies in the state. So different agencies in the state that are currently responsible for setting standards, like the Air Resources Board and the Energy Commission and the different state agencies, they're responsible for carrying out this law. I don't know what the penalties are for not meeting the standards. I think if for example, let's say by 2030, they're at 55%. I mean, right now, California's at 30% renewables and eligible renewables already. So I don't think it's that hard to get to 60% by 2030, but let's say they didn't. I don't know what the penalties would be. Maybe there aren't any immediate penalties, but I think it'd be incumbent upon the state legislatures or the governor to try to enforce the law, because I guess the governor, after all, is the one who enforces the law. So it'd be the governor's responsibility under the law to make sure it does happen. So I don't know, how exactly he would do it, or she would do it at that time. But I'm pretty sure the governor would have the power to try to enforce the law.
One way that it could be enforceable, and there's a good example of it that just happened in California. In 2011, PG&E blew up the city of San Bruno. The city forced PG&E to replace all the houses that were blown up and burned down, and then forced them to build them as solar-powered houses. Now, we have to convert to a solar economy. One of the things that we can do is now, using that example from San Bruno, force PG&E to replace all of 8,000 houses or more that were burned down, because PG&E, which was mandated, required to remove all the trees along its right-of-way underneath the wires so that none of the trees could come in contact with the wires. They didn't. I was at a hearing where they admitted they're only trimming 30%. They're not cutting down the trees. They have to be forced to cut down the trees, and they also have to be forced to replace all the houses that they burned down. The Cal Fire has found them guilty in, 16 out of 19 of the fires. Just like San Bruno, they were found guilty, guilty, guilty. We have to do this because PG&E, what they did was the money that we paid them to cut down the trees under their wires, they gave it to their stockholders as profit, which was stolen profits, basically, from the ratepayers. So we now have to claw that money back and give it to the homeowners to rebuild the houses that were burned down and rebuild all the houses as solar, as PG&E did in the city of San Bruno. So we have precedent here on our side. And we know the money was stolen.
All right, very good. Paul, that's really interesting. Mark Jacobs, where does the capacity for Diablo Canyon, the two reactors there, fit in to this green picture? Is the legislature, how is the legislature counting the capacity from Diablo Canyon?
Well, it's not considered an eligible renewable. So nuclear power in California is not considered an eligible renewable. And there's no, and it's, since Diablo Canyon, which are the has the last nuclear reactors in the state, are is shutting down, and there's no plans for any new nuclear, the SB 100 will virtually, for certain, not have any nuclear power as part of it. And so right now, California is at around 30% eligible renewables. There's also another, I don't know if the number is around 15% hydropower, which is not considered an eligible renewable, but still renewable. So California is well on its way to being completely renewable energy without nuclear power in the state. And
wow,
if the Apple Canyon shuts, we'll have to replace it, the energy, but the plan is to replace it with primarily wind and solar, and or more likely solar and wind, plus battery storage, and also there'll be some additional geothermal. But this is very feasible. We've developed plans for California, you know, for its renewable energy future for all energy sectors, and there's plenty of room available for lots of solar and lots of wind onshore and offshore of California.
Well, Mark Jacobson, how do you can you make any kind of estimate as to how much it will cost to make this transition to 100% renewable and how many jobs will be created?
Well, yeah, we have made an estimate, but the key is, I mean, it's there's what's called an upfront cost, and then there's the cost of energy, which is really the relevant metric is the cost of energy, because while wind and solar have high upfront costs, they have zero fuel costs over time, whereas fossil fuels and nuclear power also have high upfront costs, but maybe in some cases less than or more, yeah, less than wind and solar, but they have high and rising fuel costs. So really, to put them on the same playing field, you have to look at what's called the levelized cost of energy, or the basically the average cost of energy over time. And when you look at the average cost of energy right now, the cheapest forms of new electricity in the United States today are onshore wind and utility-scale solar photovoltaics. I mean, they're half the cost of natural gas for new plants when you look at the levelized cost of energy. So consumers in California will save money.
How long? I assume you're amortizing this. So how long, in your calculations, how long do you calculate that an installed new windmill or an installed new solar panel will operate, thereby, you know, lowering the cost of energy and paying down their capital costs?
Well, I'll give you two examples. So, I mean, typically a typical wind turbine or solar panel is amortized, or its lifetime is usually considered to be 25 to 30 years. In fact, solar panels in the United States, in California, are all warranted for at least 25 years. So over that period of time, that's the amortization time for wind and solar. But I'll just speak to in my own personal experience. I mean, I built a house last year, and or about a year and a half ago, and have lived in it over a year and a half now. And it has no gas. And so by not putting gas on the property, I saved around $6,000 just for the hookup fee. PG&E, my utility, was going to charge $6,000 just to hook up the gas to the property. And then I saved another around $5,000 in gas pipes that I did not need. And so right there is $11,000. And then I put solar on the roof, and this solar rooftop solar is more expensive than utility scale solar by far. It's like two or three times more. But even with that, and I have batteries in the garage. Then after that, after putting the solar and the batteries, I had no more electricity bill because I generate all my electricity from the solar and the batteries. I had no gas bill, and I even had enough solar electricity to charge two electric cars, so I had no gasoline bill. And I generated 20% more electricity than I used over the year, and so I sold the 20% back to the utility, which we now have, even though PG&E is the underlying utility for transmission distribution, we now have the option for what's called a community choice aggregation utility, which is Silicon Valley Clean Energy in this case. And there are 18 areas in California where you have this choice. where they actually pay, they take over the generation portion of your utility bill, and they pay for solar electricity at the same rate that you would pay for it. So I got a check at the end of the year for $530. So basically, no gas bill, no gasoline bill, no electric bill, and got a check back. So this pays itself off over 5 to 6 years. So just with rooftop solar, which is 2 to 3 times more expensive than utility-scale solar, it's paying itself off over 5 to 6 years, which is incredible. And part of that's because there is a subsidy for it, but even without the subsidy, it would pay itself off after 10 years. So I'd say it's just it's foolish for people not to transition to clean renewable energy at this point, in California, particularly solar. But utility large-scale solar is going to be cheaper than rooftop solar, but rooftop solar is beneficial for many purposes, especially you have less transmission distribution, you have local energy when the lights go out in the neighborhood, when the grid goes out, you can actually, in my case, actually use the electricity stored in the batteries from the solar to power the house too. So you need both rooftop solar and utility scale solar, but they're both very useful for California.
How much extra, Mark Jacobson, we're talking with Mark Jacobson. What's your title, Mark? You're a professor of what at Stanford?
Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Stanford University.
Okay, so how much extra upfront did it cost you to put the solar on this house that you just built? In other words, what was the cost difference if you hadn't put solar on?
I electrified everything. So most of the appliances were an even wash. Like, for example, I got an electric induction cooktop stove, and that was about the same cost as a gas stove. I got a heat pump water heater that runs on electricity, and that cost maybe a little bit more than a normal water heater, but it just it uses one-fourth the energy, so it's just so much cheaper over time, but only a few $100 more, I think, up front. And then for air heating and air conditioning, I got a heat pump, air conditioner, and air heater. And again, they use one-fourth the energy as a gas heater or a regular air conditioner. But remember, I saved $6,000 just for the gas hookup fee and another, there was a $7,000 for the pipes. And so you save a huge amount right there just for not putting gas on the property. With respect to all the appliances, that more than makes up for it. Now, their solar system is something extra, and that cost for this house, it was up front before tax credits and tax rebates, is on the order of $50,000. So that's where the big bite is. But there is a 30% tax credit in the United States for solar, and so you take that off immediately. And as I mentioned, because you're saving annually each year, and there's no more electric bill because of the solar, there's no more gas bill or even gasoline bill in this case. That was enough solar to put to charge electric cars. It pays itself off over 5 to 6 years with the subsidy.
Wow, fantastic. That's amazing. Linda Seeley, have you joined us from San Luis Obispo?
Yes, I have.
Oh, good.
How are
okay,
you?
Very good. Well, we're getting good. How are you? You may have missed up front. We're celebrating today the permanent shutdown of the Oyster Creek nuclear plant, which I think actually that moves Diablo Canyon up from the third most embrittled to the second most embrittled because Oyster Creek,
right.
I think, was number one. So there you go. And we're with Paul Kangas. Paul, I want you to, if you can, you have been proposing. Mark, how many actual panels did you have to put on your roof to power your house?
Well, this is 13.6 kilowatts of solar. So each, I don't remember the exact number, but each one is around 350 watts. So it's on the order. So just
so that'd probably be about 40 or 50 panels.
Yeah, on that order.
Okay.
Yeah, Hart,
so Paul Kangas. Yes, Linda, please.
At the other end of the spectrum, I have a small house I didn't build a house. I had moved into a house that was already here, and I have a small house with a very low electric bill anyway. And I took advantage of a program here in California from a nonprofit called SunWork, S-U-N Work. And they come to your house and install solar panels. They installed 7 on my roof, which takes care of all of my energy needs, but I don't have an electric car. But it only cost, after the rebates, I only paid $3,500 for it. My initial outlay was $4,950, and after the rebate, it figured to be $3,500. That is a deal, and that's available.
Well, how long is the payback?
California.
How long will it take you, Linda Seeley, in avoided electric bills, thanks to these solar panels, how long will it take you to pay back your investment?
Let's see. My electric bill was right around like $50-$55 a month. I don't know. Probably longer
than I'll
live.
But
I don't care. For me, it's a matter of being able to generate my own power on my own roof, you know? $3,500 is well worth it. I won't probably live long enough to pay it off, but who cares?
Oh yeah, you will. Well, because if you paid $50 a month, you said what was your monthly electric bill?
Yeah, about $55 a month was my gas bill.
So if you paid $3,500, you're talking about 70 months. That's less than 6 years.
I could live that long. Yeah, yay.
Yeah, well, we would hope, yes. Very good. Paul Kangas, you have been advocating solar houses with 100 solar panels on them. Mark, how many square feet is your house?
It's 3,000 square feet, 2 stories.
That's a pretty good size house. Paul Kangas, you were negotiating various deals to have solar homes built. Can you talk about what your program has been?
Yeah, 4 years ago, I lived in Freiburg, Germany, and I lived in a house that was a fourplex, had 112 solar panels on the roof. The idea in Germany is not only to generate solar for the building, but to generate surplus solar so that you can sell it to your neighbors. And the Germans, realizing they were in a crisis, put a burden on the utilities and required the utilities to pay 99 cents a kilowatt hour to solar homeowners. So a fourplex house, the owner lives in one unit, and they're selling the surplus energy that pays about a third of the mortgage off, and then they also renting out units to tenants. So the owner is basically living there for free and selling electricity to the neighbors. And thanks to the Hans Joseph Thal and Hermann Scheer coming up with this plan, requiring the utilities to pay the solar homeowners 99 cents, everybody was very happy over there. This one farmer I was talking to had hundreds and hundreds of solar panels on his barns and chicken coop and every building on his huge farm he was at. And he said that he's making so much money from solar. And the thing is, there was a deal where if you sign the contract now, when they started this in about 2001, the contract was good for 20 years. So you're guaranteed the 99 cents a kilowatt hour for 20 years. So you're going to be making gravy after about 7 years. After your initial cost. So it was a very good thing, and they did it because they were in an emergency. That is, Chernobyl had melted down, and their goal was to shut down all the nukes, and they're going to shut down the last nuke now on Earth Day, April 22nd, 2022. I interviewed the governor of Baden over there when I was there on video, and I asked him about, is Germany going to be able to do this? And he said, most definitely, we are on track to shut down the last nuke using solar and wind. Germany has a very good situation with the amount of wind they have in the north, and these small hydro generators throughout the whole country, and then in the south, a lot of solar. And so they have a really balanced kind of situation, which I think Mark Jacobson is right about. California has got a fairly balanced situation, too, where we could easily, well, as Al Gore said in his movie, San Francisco gets enough energy in 1 hour to power the whole city for 1 year if we put enough solar panels on the schools and the houses. And so, I mean, that's the object here, is we can shut down Diablo Canyon long before the 10 years is up if enough people put enough surplus solar energy on their roofs, and we battle the utility companies and force them to pay us a premium to claw back from them the profits they've been making for the last 50 years on it. I mean, that's basically
and the
program.
Being subsidized, and basically the utilities have been subsidized by the environmental damage and the health damage that their generating facilities have been imposing on the public. I recently had a devastating conversation with several people at Porter Ranch, where Sempra has been storing poorly gas, which has blown out, and it's a devastating situation imposed on the public, for which they've paid no significant compensation. Mark Jacobson, I wanted to ask you, how much is PG&E paying you for the electricity that you're selling back to them?
Well, so this is why we have a community choice option. PG&E will hardly pay anything for the extra electricity that you generate above what you produce during a year. So at the end of the year, PG&E looks, if you just had PG&E as for both generation and transmission distribution, they would pay 2 cents per kilowatt hour for the excess electricity over what you use over the year. However,
oh my God.
So the clean choice, community choice aggregation, the CCAs, in this case Silicon Valley Clean Energy, they pay whatever the price of electricity is, and for the generation portion, which peaks at 28 cents a kilowatt hour. So they'll pay up to 28 cents a kilowatt hour for the excess electricity for the generation portion of the excess electricity that you use. And so that's how I ended up getting a check for $530 at the end of the year.
Otherwise, so if it had been 99 cents, like in Germany, you would have gotten three times as much.
Yeah. So there, I think it's the feed-in tariff that gives you the 99
right.
cents. But this is much better than it used to be with PG&E. So I would recommend anybody who has the option to go to a community choice. And there are 18 of them in California.
Go ahead,
I want to ask Mark a question, and all of you. Why would Jerry Brown, if he wants us to go 100% renewable by 2045, why on earth would he be supporting new oil drilling now and fracking in California?
Yeah, well, I can't
Mark.
Read his mind, but first his support of SB 100. I mean, he only signed it 2 weeks ago. But he also issued the executive order, which really requires no new. Means effectively 100% renewable energy for all energy sectors, plus even removing carbon from the atmosphere, possibly. So he's kind of like, by keeping allowing oil and gas to continue in the state, he's probably speaking a little bit on both sides of his mouth. He's allowing energy to be exported, but not used in the state. And dirty energy to be exported, but not used in the state. And also keep in mind that oil in particular is used for transportation, not for electric power. So that wouldn't necessarily conflict with SB 100. It would conflict with his executive order. But our goal is really to transition everything to clean renewable energy, and which across the whole world and the United States and California, which really requires stop using oil, stop using gas, stop using coal for everything.
Right. Does SB 100? Wait, Paul, 1 second. Does SB 100 not deal with transportation?
Correct. It's only electric power. But his executive order does effectively deal with transportation, though.
How? What does the executive order say about transportation?
Well, it doesn't say specifically, but it requires greenhouse gas emissions to go to zero in the state, and the only way you can do that is to go to electrified transportation, effectively,
right,
as well as industry, and get rid of gas in homes for heating,
uh-huh,
and as well as electricity. So you can't meet that executive order without totally getting rid of oil, coal, and gas use in the state entirely.
Okay, Paul Kangas, did you want to jump in?
Yes. Here's another way of looking at what Brown is doing. The working class wants to keep the lights on. So the problem is those of us in the solar power movement are not moving fast enough to try and shift the energy to solar and wind and hydro. When we get more solar, wind, and hydro, then that justifies shutting down the nukes and shutting down the oil. And so we have to start developing more electrified transportation, which is happening. There's a company in Lancaster, California, making electric buses and electric trucks. It's called BYD, Build Your Own Dream. So we in the solar movement are just not pushing hard enough. We're not going fast enough. And I take responsibility for that we're not going fast enough. I do it. I work on it every day, trying to get more people motivated to doing it. Like, for instance, we need to somehow require PG&E to rebuild all those buildings that they burned down in Northern California, just like they did in San Bruno. And so that's the campaign I'm on right now. And I'm also a candidate for the San Francisco Board of Education, and I'm pushing there for adding 1,000 solar panels to each San Francisco school. We already have one school that has 1,000 solar panels, and they did it 20 years ago. There's no reason why they shouldn't be doing 1,000 solar panels on every school in California.
Well, that's a great idea. Thank you for that, Paul. I want to ask Mark, you said earlier that central solar is cheaper than rooftop solar. Are you accounting also for transmission costs?
Yeah, well, I'm looking. If you look at the PPAs, power purchase agreements for solar, I mean, some of them are down to 2.5-3 cents a kilowatt hour, and that's with a subsidy. And you take that's a production tax credit subsidy, that is. And so if you add that back in, that's like 4 to 4.5 cents a kilowatt hour. And rooftop solar, if you actually look at the cost per kilowatt hour, it's on the order of, it could be anywhere from 13 to 15 cents a kilowatt hour, or sometimes higher, sometimes lower than that. But it's not even close to the 4.5 to 5 cents kilowatt hour unsubsidized. So, the transmission distribution portion of that is relatively small. So, you know, utility scale, it's just because you can, in fact, if you have a community, like, so the rooftop solar I just gave you price is for like one house. But if you have like a community of, let's say, 10 houses, and they all went in solar, it's actually like one half the price of one rooftop. It's just because the labor cost is so high for one house. But if you spread that labor over multiple houses, it actually goes down quite a bit. It's an economies of scale.
Right.
Then if you go to 100 houses or, you know, commercial scale buildings or large power plants, it gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. It's just the larger the system you put up at one time, the cheaper it gets. And it can be like a third to a fourth the cost of one rooftop, well, of a large-scale photovoltaic system and utility scale versus one rooftop, just due to economies of scale.
So it's all bound up in the labor to install the panels on the rooftop. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, and you get some discount with buying multiple panels versus a few panels.
Harvey, Mark raises a really good point. Harvey, Mark raises a really good point.
Go
Whenever
ahead.
You transmit electricity over a wire beyond 100 miles, correct me if I'm wrong, but you start losing the value, the energy is lost when it's over 100-mile transmission. So these giant solar farms in Central California along the Nevada border are trying to sell their electricity all over California, and they can't make a profit, and Ivanpah is going broke. Ivanpah is now for sale because it's going broke. So you have to have decentralization. Solar has got to be based on decentralization, where we build housing all over the world so that when the sun is rotating, when we're rotating around the sun, you will have houses in some parts of the earth that will be generating solar energy, and the other part will be sleeping. So basically it's decentralization is the way to go.
Is it really? Is it 100 miles? I mean, I thought that transmission of electricity lost a substantial percentage way short of 100 miles. Do you have numbers on that, Mark?
Well, I should first clarify, Ivanpah is not a photovoltaic farm. It's a concentrated solar power, so it's a totally different type of solar farm.
Oh, yeah. It's a power, right?
Yeah, so that which is concentrated solar is much more expensive than photovoltaics. So I'm referring to the large-scale, utility-scale photovoltaic farms. And it depends what type of transmission. So you can, if you have high-voltage direct current, you can go like 2,000 miles and you only lose like 9% of your energy. But with AC transmission, you're right, you lose a lot. And so, yeah, you don't want to go long distance with AC transmission. Because then you'll lose a lot. But you can solve the problem with high-voltage direct current, which there is a lot, but it's not easy to cite these days. But you don't have
to go. On your house, Mark, where you put the solar system, do you have an inverter?
Yeah. There's an inverter that connects the solar to the batteries and then to the grid.
How much energy do you lose from your inverter?
I don't know the number offhand, but there are losses through the inverter. There are losses in the battery, but everything turns out. I mean, even through all the losses, and there's also degradation of the solar over time. Although it's not huge, but it's slow degradation over time, and then you get dust gets on the panels, and that reduces the efficiency as well.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, despite all the losses, I mean, the overall system is still very efficient. I mean, it's very productive, and it's generating far more energy than I'm using, and I'm able to send excess energy back to the grid, which is what counts. So, but this is when you're sizing the system, you're accounting for these losses, or at least estimating these losses, so you size the system properly in the first place.
Uh-huh. Okay, so listen, we are going to continue this in a minute, but we have to jump over to the major turning point situation that we have at Diablo Canyon, because we only got about 15 minutes left. And we have in February, I believe, Linda, you may have the exact date, Diablo Canyon Unit 1, which is now the second most embrittled core in the United States, is going to shut for refueling. And
that's right.
The World Business Academy took PG&E to court to try and force a test of the reactor core for embrittlement, and they lost in court. So we won't be able at this point to legally force PG&E to do this test. But I may be wrong about that. I hope I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Also have a new governor at the time. I assume that Gavin Newsom is going to win and that he'll be inaugurated sometime in January. Is that when the governors are inaugurated here in California? I believe so. So, Linda Seeley, can you comment on the situation at Diablo Canyon in terms of testing the core for embrittlement?
Sure. First of all, the lawsuit was not against PG&E. It was against the State Lands Commission, and actually Gavin Newsom is the head of the State Lands Commission. But it was had to do with part of the contentions in the case were about the embrittlement of the Unit 1 reactor vessel, and which had to do with the State Lands Commission granting an extension of the license for the state lands at Diablo Canyon, which that license, or I mean not license, lease of the land.
Lease.
Yeah, that lease was due to expire this year in 2018, and they extended the lease out to 2025 without doing an EIR. At the end of the lease, they are supposed to do an EIR. The lease was supposed to end in 18. And rather than complying with law, they just sort of extended the lease so they wouldn't have to do an EIR.
And EIR is an environmental impact review. Now, my understanding from you, Linda, is that inserted in the core at Diablo Canyon are something called coupons, and that if when the reactor is shut, it would be very simple for PG&E to remove a coupon or two, I guess, and to ascertain how embrittled the core really is. Now, just for our listeners, there's a reactor pressure vessel in every nuclear plant. It's a large cylinder, basically, stainless steel, I think 6 inches thick, and it's what contains the nuclear reaction in a nuclear power plant. And these reactor cores are bombarded with heat and radiation over their 20, 30-year lifespan, and they get embrittled. They undergo chemical changes. And if a reactor core is sufficiently embrittled, God forbid if there's an accident and water is poured in, instead of retaining its structural integrity, the reactor core will shatter like glass, and God forbid we have a Chernobyl or a Fukushima. Is that an accurate description, Linda? Linda Seeley, are you still with us? Oh, shoot.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm here. I hit my mute button by mistake. The thing about the reactor vessel, the fragile part or vulnerable part of the reactor vessel are the welds that are on the inside of the vessel. And what happened with this Unit 1 reactor vessel was that this thing was manufactured in 1973. And at that time, they hadn't done enough study on the embrittlement. And so as I understand it, I may not be completely correct here, but I think there is too high of a ratio of copper in the welds on the inside of, actually, it's not even just on the inside. These things are built, they're almost, if you can picture like what an artichoke looks like, they're built like that with this overlapping structures. Like if you have one artichoke going up and another one going down, so that it's very, very secure and tight. But, it has tons of welds in it. So what they do when they manufacture these things is they make coupons. They're called coupons. They're little pieces of metal that are made of exactly the same material as the welds. And so what they can do is they can extract one of those things out of it to test how those welds are doing, if they are becoming embrittled. And so the last time they pulled a coupon out of Unit 1 was in 2003. And they are supposed to do a coupon check once every 10 years by law. 2013 came around when it was time to do another check of the coupon. PG&E applied for an exemption to that, stating that they're now using like robotic surveillance of the inside of the reactor vessel, but that you cannot actually, the way that they do the testing of these coupons is what they call destructive testing.
meaning they destroy it somehow. I'm not exactly sure. Mark, you might know about this more than I. But they destroy it to see, and that gives them the data that they need in order to make a really concrete assessment of how those welds are doing. They got their exemption in 2013. They got it held off until 2024, until it shuts down. So basically, we're going to be here with that now second most embrittled plant or reactor vessel in the whole United States that is not being checked for over 20 years since the last check because they applied for an exemption. So what we are promoting, Mothers for Peace, is to ask them to do it. They're going to have an outage this February, and they could remove a coupon from the reactor vessel at that time and test it. And because if it's fine, great. We'll feel a lot happier and safer. But if it's not, we need to know. But there is no harm in testing. There can only be harm from not testing.
So how do
here's a good example of how they do the test. San Bruno, PG&E decided to see whether or not the gas pipe was brittle, and here's how they tested it. They pumped 4 times as much gas through the pipeline as they normally put through that pipeline under the city of San Bruno. And they did it in order to pump surplus gas to San Francisco and make a profit. They thought, okay, we'll do the test and we'll make a profit at the same time. We'll simply pump 4 times as much gas through the pipe. Well, it blew up. That's why the fire was so fierce, because it blew up. And it may have had just happened in Massachusetts. They may have been testing a pipeline in Massachusetts when it blew up and created that series of explosions.
Unbelievable. Mark Jacobson, are you familiar with this technology?
No, I'm not so familiar with that. Can't say much about it.
All right, so the question then, well, let me ask you real quick, Mark. If Diablo Canyon did not reopen starting next February, is there enough surplus renewable and other energy sources in the California grid to not miss the capacity from Diablo, which would be, I guess, what, about 1,200 megawatts from one unit?
First of all, solar in particular can be put up very rapidly. I mean, it could be put up anywhere from 1 year to 3 years. You can install huge amounts of solar. So if we know the exact time that Diablo Canyon would shut down, I mean, we know right now the end date, I think it was like 2025, if not before, we can certainly plan for that. And if we only have a window to plan, that is actually still time to put up, to plan and install huge amounts of solar in particular, but also wind as well to replace it. And I'm not concerned about that because California must replace all nuclear and all gas on the grid now with renewable energy effectively by 2045, with 60% by 2030. You know, it's actually mandated to, this replacement has to start right now.
Okay.
There's a company that's poised now, an offshore wind company, where they put the wind turbines 30 to 40 miles offshore. Each turbine is, 15 kilowatts. Does that make sense?
No. It'd be 5 megawatts. I think 5 megawatts is about as big as they're going right now. Is that right, Mark?
Actually, the biggest is 12 megawatts, but GE has a 12 megawatt offshore turbine.
That's what they were.
I remember, by the way, I want to say something. In 1975, I went to a conference in UMass in Amherst, and William Hieronymus proposed 5 megawatts offshore windmills, and everybody laughed at him and said it would never happen. And now we're up to 12. I'm sure it's going to go higher. Linda, I know what you're about to say, but real quick, is there a legal way to force PG&E to do these tests when it shuts down in February 2019, next year?
I don't know. We met with the NRC 2 weeks ago and asked them to do it. They said that they would not request or order PG&E to do it because PG&E had met the requirements for proving that it's okay to leave it for another 10 years or 7
years.
Oh,
God. Listen, we got to find a legal way to force them to do this.
Yeah.
This is ridiculous. Gavin Newsom will be governor when this happens. This is a campaign I hope Mark and, of course, Paul will jump in on. We're almost out of time. Mark Jacobson, can you tell people how to get a hold of you and what your latest works are?
I have on my Stanford University website, which you can just search under Mark Z. Jacobson, we have all our papers that we published on the topics of 100% clean and renewable energy roadmaps for states and countries and cities and towns. I'm also on Twitter at MZ Jacobson, JACOBSON.
Okay.
I give updates.
Real quick, Paul Kangas, how do people get a hold of you?
Oh, it's easy. I'm on YouTube. I put a new video up about one or two a day. Paul 8, the number 8, the figure 8, Kangas, YouTube. And I've got about 5 million hits right now. I have about 5,000 videos up, mainly on solar.
Okay.
And so I'm easy to find.
All right, good. And Linda Seeley, Mothers for Peace?
Mothersforpeace.org.
Out of San Luis Obispo. So... this, you guys have been fantastic. What a great show. Let's shut the Apple Canyon. We'll be back next week. See you in Solartopia.
Thanks, Harvey.
Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're going to have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're going to have a Solartopia, all over God's green world.
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world.
Well, we multiplied, we needed